said last Friday and this weekend that Michael Cohen was radioactive and that anybody that was associated with him in the last 20 to 30 years should be very, very concerned. What we witnessed earlier in the hearing with the disclosure relating to Sean Hannity proved my point exactly. He is radioactive. Anyone that had any contact with this man in the last 20 years should be very concerned about what secrets of theirs are within these documents.
Michael Avenatti, attorney for the adult film star Stormy Daniels, speaking outside a Manhattan courtroom today. He was there because President Donald Trump's embattled personal attorney, Michael Cohen, was also in that courtroom today. Cohen's court appearance comes after the FBI raided his offices last week looking for information on payments to two women who claim to have had affairs with the president. At issue in court today was who gets access to the troves of documents the agents seized. Also, which of those documents is protected by attorney-client privilege? Jessica Levinson is here to help us break it all down. She is a law professor at Loyola Law School and our Monday regular Legal. Hello.
Happy Monday.
Hi. Well, this story just keeps on churning along. Big news came out today that a third client of Michael Cohen's is none other than Sean Hannity. And so I guess that's what Michael Avenatti was referring to. So what do we know about what the relationship between Michael Cohen and Sean Hannity is?
Well, we know that it looks like Michael Cohen's legal team thinks that there was an attorney-client relationship because they named him as a client, whereas Sean Hannity earlier today basically said, no, I didn't form an attorney-client relationship with him. I would note, though, that if you really parse Sean Hannity's comments, it doesn't necessarily indicate that they didn't form an attorney-client relationship. It indicates that if we're really to take Sean Hannity's word for it, at the very least, he didn't understand what was happening. But, for instance, Sean Hannity pointed to things like, you know, I never got an invoice, we never signed a letter. You actually can form an attorney-client relationship without billing someone. For instance, there's pro bono legal representation, and without a letter, without reducing to writing and saying, we have now formed this relationship.
He says, I assumed those conversations were confidential. This is his official statement. But to be absolutely clear, they never involved any matter between me and a third party, I guess, referring to payments made to the women in this case. What about the first part about that, though? I assumed those conversations were confidential. Shouldn't he have a right to that confidentiality?
Well, I mean, there's an assumption that when you're talking to somebody that something's confidential, and then there's whether or not you have a legal right to it. And it's interesting because in a sense, it feels like Sean Hannity's trying to have it both ways, where he's saying, I'm covered by the privilege, that's confidential, but I didn't necessarily form an attorney-client relationship. And so the question for the court today really was, who looks at all the documents that were seized to determine what is confidential and therefore what cannot be turned over to the prosecutor? So there's nothing here to indicate that all of a sudden we've tossed the attorney-client privilege out the door and that these conversations are no longer confidential. We're just determining who's going to look to determine whether or not things are privileged.
Right. And so what did the judge, Kimba Wood, decide today with regards to that question?
Well, Kimba Wood, it looks like, has said basically, no, Mr. Cohen and Mr. Trump, you do not get to be the ones who just determine whether or not this information is privileged, because they had essentially asked, well, why don't we just be the quote-unquote filter team? So she's essentially said the government can look at this, and then I think 10 days later, Mr. Cohen's team can look at this. She's reserved the right to say whether or not she will later appoint a so-called special master, which is essentially a neutral party that's just going to do the check to see whether or not this information is privileged. And I think she's also reserved the right to determine whether or not the Department of Justice will have a so-called filter team, which is a team separate from the prosecutors. And that's a team that just goes through to look to see whether or not information is privileged, which actually shows the weight that the Department of Justice is giving to the attorney-client privilege. The whole idea that are going to either appoint a special master or create an entirely walled-off team shows that we are still respecting that privilege.
So if the judge rejected Trump and his lawyer from blocking prosecutors to get these materials, what happens now? Are they going to just feel free to go through them?
Well, I think ultimately we haven't made a final decision on what happens to the materials, but this is not a win for President Trump and Mr. Cohen and his team, who said, no, 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 do not let the Department of Justice look at that. And again, let's remember, this is the President of the United States making an argument that we cannot trust the Department of Justice to do its job and look through to determine what's privileged and what is not privileged.
And what would be protected?
Well, communications between an attorney and a client, as long as it's not covered by an exception. And the exception that everybody has been talking about recently is the crime fraud exception, which in general terms means if you are talking to your attorney and you are basically plotting to commit a crime or a fraud, that you don't get to avail yourself of the protection of the attorney-client privilege. So if the conversation either constitutes planning a crime or constitutes a crime in and of itself, you can't call your attorney and say, you know, I was thinking of murdering someone. If you could pick me up at this block at this time, that would be fantastic. You don't get to withhold that information and say attorney-client privilege.
Okay. Another thing that's come out of all this is another attorney's name, which keeps popping up, and this is Keith Davidson, who at some point has represented all three women who signed non-disclosure agreements after having purported affairs with Donald Trump, they claim, or someone in his orbit, another client, actually, of Michael Cohen's. And this lawyer who represented all three is Keith Davidson. So is that a strange coincidence or not?
I think it's not a coincidence. So attorneys have niche practices, and this is a somewhat bizarre niche. But what happens is, in these cases, is that you get a certain reputation, you develop certain relationships, and therefore it's not a coincidence that you are the, you know, quote-unquote go-to person, even though this is a strange set of circumstances. I mean, there's the go-to person in antitrust law, in insurance law, in medical malpractice, and this area in a way is no different. It's just how you have cultivated those relationships may be a little bit more surprising to the public, let's say.
Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's get into that discussion now about Keith Davidson, known as the go-to guy in L.A. if you're a porn star, an escort, or if you're, say, trying to cash in on a D-list celebrity sex tape. He has tried or succeeded in shaking down payments for the likes of Hulk Hogan, Charlie Sheen, and Tila Tequila. So you get the idea. For more on Davidson's past, we're joined now by Bill Bastone. He is investigative reporter and editor of The Smoking Gun. Bill, thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so you've been working actually on this story about Keith Davidson for a couple of years now, long before all of the Stormy Daniels news broke. Why were you interested in him?
Essentially because he has a practice, a legal practice like none other. He's the guy, as you previously mentioned, who for the last decade or so is the guy that the lawyer in Los Angeles that you go to if you have a sex tape that you're looking to monetize somehow, or if you have negative information about, a public figure that you're looking to somehow make money off of. And he specializes in not disseminating that material or having that material published. He's the guy who reaches out to the celebrity and or their attorney and tries to strike a deal to have the material quashed so that it never surfaces. Hmm. And that's a practice that is really unique, and it's one that he pretty much has cornered the market on. I can't say that I could point to another attorney who does what he does, and that's pretty much why I started looking at him a long time ago, kind of got sidetracked, and then kind of picked it up again in the past several months.
So how do these people know to go to him? So like Stormy Daniels, for example, she says, oh, I've got this story to tell about Donald Trump. How does she know to call up Keith Davidson?
The key part of his practice is he has had over the past decade or so a small group of individuals who have worked as steerers, for lack of a better word. These are people who, you know, are kind of on the periphery of the entertainment business, you know, might have been involved in the adult movie business. And they have been the source of dozens of case referrals for him. And that breaks down to, you know, there's a handful of individuals. One guy is known as the Hollywood's like sex tape broker. He has delivered, you know, more than a dozen clients to Davidson. There's a woman who is herself a former porn actress who's a person who has deep ties in the adult industry and has delivered, you know, porn actresses, people who claim to have been mistresses for, you know, Tiger Woods, people like that. So she's a source. And he's also, over the years, has received direct referrals from a journalist from the website TMZ, who now has last year started his own website, but has been for many years one of the leading figures in celebrity journalism and has referred clients to Davidson as well. So it's not as if, you know, if you come across a sex tape or you have a sex tape that involves a celebrity, you would know to go to Keith Davidson, but you might know one of these people who's served as referrers for him. And they've played a very central role in kind of the growth of his practice, as it were.
So why would TMZ want to refer people to Davidson when what he did mainly was quash this sex tape or the story of the affair? Wouldn't they want to have that and publish it?
Well, I mean, I think they've tried to have it both ways. I mean, if you look at there's a particular arc that follows every kind of sex tape story that finds its way into a TMZ or kind of other similar publication, and that is there'll be a story that comes out that says, oh, there's a sex tape involving celebrity A. And then there'll be a follow-up story. There's a big bidding war that's taking place, you know, among like porn movie studios. And, you know, and then suddenly there'll be some sort of story about how, you know, the celebrity is trying to keep it under wraps. And all the while, these are generating exclusives that get published on TMZ. And at the same time, TMZ will never publish a sex tape. They will not do that. You know, they're kind of a middle-of-the-road celebrity website. And they also know that they would be in legal jeopardy were they to do that. But they write about the existence of it. They'll write about what takes place on the tape. They'll write about the frenzy in the market to buy the tape, this whole arc of stories that they publish as exclusives. You know, their stories then get picked up in all these other places. So they get the benefit of the churn of the story. And the person who at TMZ who was responsible for these stories had an incredibly close relationship with Davidson and directed these people to Davidson for legal representation.
Would there be any kickbacks? I mean, so it sounds like TMZ kind of scares the celebrity about the sex tape and then Davidson gets the money from them to not air it.
Essentially, it serves as I wrote in our story, it serves as the series of stories serve essentially as kind of a friendly reminder to the celebrity that, you know, it might be in your interest to kind of quash this because though a website like TMZ may not publish it, there's always the concern on the part of a celebrity that the tape might get out somewhere else, might be leaked someplace online, might be posted to a website that has its servers outside of the United States. And there's the fear that once it gets out, once it hits the web, it's going to be forever on the web.
Okay.
I should note that I don't think that there's necessarily any indication that TMZ as an organization was involved with what its former employee was doing. He was the person who had the relationship. He was the person who actually was represented as used Davidson as a lawyer. This journalist's father used Davidson as a lawyer. Another member of the family might have used Davidson as a lawyer. And when asked about whether, you know, when I asked Davidson about, you know, did you ever charge for your legal services? well, you know, he said, well, maybe, or no, I may have just done it for free because he was a friend of mine. And, you know, then I asked him, were there any instances where the TMZ editor was paid for these? Well, he didn't want to answer that question. So, you know, what the benefit was for steering clients like this, that's a little, it's a little unknown.
But okay,
it's
like, so it, meanwhile,
it's the kind of behavior that you could never, ever get away with at a legitimate news organization.
Right. And so meanwhile, the two women who claim to have had affairs with President Trump are also suing Keith Davidson, basically saying that that Davidson was secretly working with Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, and not representing their best interests?
Well, I mean, they haven't named him as a defendant, though they have made allegations essentially saying it's Karen McDougal, who was the Playboy playmate, who is suing to get out from underneath the non-disclosure agreement that she signed with essentially the National Enquirer and its parent company, American Media. Mm-hmm. In her complaint that she filed, she levels a lot of serious accusations against Davidson. Davidson is not named as a defendant, but he is raked over the coals in the lawsuit that she filed that names the National Enquirer as a defendant. And she mm-hmm. basically says he, Davidson, was not really representing her. He was representing the interests Michael Cohen was interested in, and he was doing this behind her back, and Davidson was having contacts behind her back that she didn't know anything about, and that she kind of was pushed into signing an agreement that she really didn't understand. And her contention is that Davidson was not really representing her interests. He was representing the interests of others that she was totally unaware of.
Okay, we'll have to leave it
there.
She
fired him.
Yeah.
As did Stormy Daniels.
They have other attorneys now that their cases have gotten more publicity.
Correct.
We're going to have to leave it there, but there's tons more in your article at The Smoking Gun. Bill Bestone, investigative editor, a reporter at The Smoking Gun, where you can read his article on Keith Davidson. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Mayor Eric Garcetti unveils his plans for emergency homeless shelters. Will it be enough? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti used his State of the City address today to focus attention on homelessness. Garcetti announced the city will spend $430 million to fight homelessness next year, including $20 million on emergency shelters.
In Los Angeles, we are seizing this moment, fighting to make sure that our children don't have to ask us anymore, why is that woman sleeping on a bench, Daddy? Doesn't she have someone to take care of her? The answer is yes. We are going to take care of her. The city of Los Angeles is going to take care of her and bring her home.
Mayor Garcetti, in his State of the City speech today, the mayor's and the city's handling of the homeless crisis has been criticized for some time now. Not enough money, poorly run programs, no political will. Some of that criticism has come from the LA Times editorial board. They've written extensively about homelessness in Los Angeles, calling it, among other things, a national disgrace. Carla Hall is a member of that board. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what did you think of Garcetti's promises today?
Well, let me say, I think he was very eloquent, and I think his plan to have shelters, we certainly need interim housing, is a good idea. However, I think his plan raises as many concerns, if not more, than it answers. He says that every council district will get a certain amount of money if they can create shelter that will shelter 100 people. Well, that's 1,500 people, and we have 25,000 unsheltered people in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes, that's good, 1,500 beds or whatever is a good idea, but what happens to the rest of the people who don't manage to get a bed? And are they going to be shooed away from their homeless encampments on the street when they really have no place to go?
Right. And what is the incentive for these districts to establish those shelters in the first place?
Apparently, the incentive is if you do the sheltering and if the communities go along with it, then you'll get more cleanup in that community and you will get, I guess, Bureau of Sanitation discouraging homeless people from camping in that area. But the fact remains that 100 beds in every council district won't begin to shelter everyone who's unsheltered in every council district. So it's a little, I understand communities thinking, well, hey, we've, you know, helped create these shelters. Our streets should be clean now. But in fact, it's just not enough shelter. So it's sort of unfair to shoo the homeless people off those streets when there really was no bed for them anyway.
Let's play a little clip of tape of him announcing this program.
Homeless Angelenos can't wait years to get off our streets. We need more options for bringing them inside now. This week, thanks to the City Council, we will put in place an emergency shelter crisis declaration so we can build shelters across LA as quickly as possible, bypassing red tape and regulations that would slow down the urgency of that construction.
Is that the primary obstacle to creating emergency shelters, the red tape and regulations?
Well, I think it'll certainly help anyone who wants to put up shelter or anyone who wants to do a safe parking lot has to go through some, you know, permitting stuff. So if they can get rid of some of that red tape, that would be good. But no, I think the biggest obstacle is finding enough places to build housing that's real permanent housing and building it fast enough, and then finding enough places to do actual really good shelter. There's no point, I think, in recreating a bunch of winter armories all over the city where it's just a big, vast gymnasium full of cots. Homeless people don't want to be in places like that, and homeless advocates say those aren't good places for anyone to be. We need to create smaller interim housing. We need to create places where people can have their own bed and their own space, maybe their own bedroom. And that's challenging, but that's really what we need to create.
Right. And he says, well, that's what we're doing with Measure HHH money, is we will be spending that money on longer-term projects.
Right. Well, I think he feels like the Measure, yes, right, the HHH money will definitely create the long-term housing. And he's right. It will take years to do it. But even in the interim, you can't just have a big gymnasium with cots. Mm-hmm. I think you've got to have something that's more livable. And whether that means renting bunches of motel rooms in the interim or whether it means setting up FEMA-like trailers where people have almost a cubicle or a bedroom to themselves, I mean, those would all be better than just giant rooms.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned FEMA, and I'm wondering if you think that he, Mayor Garcetti, has conveyed the urgency enough. In other words, has he sort of struck a tone that this is like a natural disaster, like an earthquake that has hit our city, that we need to try to mobilize state and national resources to attack this from all angles, to maybe mobilize the National Guard to start building emergency shelters? I don't know, anything along those lines that conveys the sense of urgency.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but I do think he actually struck a tone of urgency where he talked about this is the crisis of our time and we've got to address it. He's gone up to the state to ask for some of that surplus money, which I think is fine. Good. I hope he gets it. I think that he has struck the right tone. It's just a matter of putting it into action. And it's also a matter of convincing communities that this is the way you solve homelessness. You don't solve homelessness by having police and Bureau of Sanitation workers shoo homeless people away from your sidewalk or your park. That the only way to get it solved is to create both interim housing and permanent housing. I was struck when he said that he felt that NIMBYism was kind of, you know, on the way out. And I still see a lot of NIMBYism. I think he's still got some work there.
Yeah, you just have to look at Orange County and see what's happening there.
Yes, right, right.
Carla Hall is an LA Times editorial board member who writes about homelessness. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, how the creation of Beverly Hills paved the way for celebrities to run for office.
They didn't have to start with school board and dog catcher and then go to citywide offices or statewide offices. They could start with governor.
The origin of Beverly Hills, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In a lot of ways, the city of Beverly Hills represents the extreme end of the American dream. A-list celebrities, palatial houses, flashy cars, nearly all the best things extravagant wealth can buy can be found inside the city's boundaries. But the Beverly Hills we know today nearly didn't exist. In the 1920s, the tiny city was facing a looming water crisis. Its residents had a choice: join Los Angeles and secure access to the ample water flowing through its new aqueduct, or remain independent. We know what happened. Beverly Hills is still a city after all. But the story behind that vote involves that very same celebrity cachet the city is known for today. That history is the subject of a new book by LA-based author Nancy Clare. It's called The Battle for Beverly Hills, A City's Independence and the Birth of Celebrity Politics. Nancy Clare joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, what was Beverly Hills like way back then at the beginning of the 20th century? What did it look like?
It didn't look like much. It looked like dusty roads and treeless vistas. If you look at aerial photography of the earliest days of Beverly Hills, you see streets laid out and not a whole lot on them.
And it wasn't even named Beverly Hills.
It was named Beverly Hills when it was incorporated in 1914, and they called the hotel the Beverly Hills Hotel. So somewhere before 1906, they named it Beverly. Beverly, Beverly Hills, they seem to be interchangeable.
Interesting. Okay, so one of the key players in your story is the silent screen star Mary Pickford. Talk a little bit about her and how she became such a big celebrity, because she was kind of like the Beyoncé of her day, right?
You know, Beyoncé and Angelina Jolie and all of that rolled into one. She had started out in Toronto as a child star. She had gone to New York City and been on the stage. In 1910, she came out to Los Angeles with D.W. Griffith to film a number of films. She became famous. She was asked by William McAdoo, the Secretary of the Treasury for Woodrow Wilson during World War I, to head the Liberty Bond Drive to sell war bonds. And I think that's when she realized her influence, her capability to influence and draw crowds.
So she would go around the country and attend rallies and try to get people to buy these things?
She went on a tour, and she was asked by the government. They went to Washington, D.C. At the launch, they raised $3 million. And this is in 1923 money. And then they had a schedule. She was with Douglas Fairbanks, who was then her secret lover, before he became her husband, Charlie Chaplin, and Marie Dressler from New York met her. And they each had a route, and Mary Pickford's was through the Northeast, and she handily outsold Charlie Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks.
What was it about Mary Pickford? Why was she so beloved?
I wish I could give like a single word answer, but I think that she just embodied the American dream of sort of the girl woman. She was innocence personified. And I think men and women projected something onto her. Not unlike today when we see somebody in a role and we say to ourselves, oh, you know, I know him or I know that person. There's a connection. Mm-hmm. She was someone with whom audiences connected.
So is she basically the first or one of the first bona fide celebrities in the way that we understand celebrities today?
I would say so, yes. I mean, Charlie Chaplin was also a celebrity in the way we would determine a celebrity as a celebrity. And certainly her husband, Douglas Fairbanks. But along with Douglas Fairbanks, she was half of the first power couple. That's for sure.
So they are like Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Beyonce and Jay-Z of the 20s. Absolutely.
And they create this compound called Pickfair.
They create this compound called Pickfair. Douglas Fairbanks first moved to Beverly Hills in 1918, and he rented an estate. And he asked Stanley Anderson, who was one of the owners of the Beverly Hills Hotel, if he could help him find like a secluded place where he could, you know, hang out. And so Stanley did that, a small hunting lodge with no electricity or running water on Summit Drive, just north of the hotel. And this hunting lodge and 18 acres is what evolved into Pickfair. But before it evolved into Pickfair, it was their love nest.
Mm, because they were both married to others.
They were both married to other people. And it was the 20s. There was, and Mary Pickford was very, very scandal averse. She did not want her name in the papers in any sort of negative way. She was all about positive press.
So here they are in this love nest, which is far away from Los Angeles, from Hollywood at the time. Was that part of the allure of Beverly Hills, was that it was secluded and away from prying eyes?
I think that was a large part of the lure. I think that at this point, by the time they got married in 1920, they were so famous that when they left for their honeymoon, there were riots on the New York docks. When they landed in Southampton, Douglas Fairbanks had to put Mary Pickford, who was tiny, on his shoulders because the English fans essentially wanted to love her to death. And the seclusion was definitely part of it. And then the social aspects were also part of it. Los Angeles couldn't wait to become like its sister and brother cities on the east and in the south. They had a social register. You know, they wanted to know who your parents were, how much money, what kind of business you were in. And there was already a prejudice against what they called movies. And that was what they called the people. They called the actors and actresses movies. And Douglas Fairbanks was half Jewish and very, very conscious of that. And Beverly Hills was a clean slate.
But you write that Beverly Hills and Hollywood, ironically, weren't too keen on having movie stars in their midst.
No, Hollywood had been founded as a teetotaling Christian city in 1903, the irony, and had voted to join Los Angeles in 1910 because of water. Eventually, Mulholland's water was going to come. Beverly Hills had so few residents that when one complained to Stanley Anderson that they didn't want movie folk to live there, much like Bel Air, just to the west, Stanley went to see that person to talk him off the ledge, to say, look, this is the future. And they talked the nervous Nellie off the ledge, and you know, the rest is history. It became a magnet for celebrities.
So then Beverly Hills is faced with this water crisis. They have to decide, are we going to join up with Los Angeles and get all that bounteous water from the Owens River Valley? Or are we going to stay on our own? And we know that they decided the latter, but what went into that decision?
Well, the decision, the Rodeo Land and Water Company was the developers that had founded the city. And I think they found it very easy to get into the water business. But as the city grew, they needed more water. And it just seemed for the people who had to pay for the wells and the purification of the water that it would be easier to join Los Angeles. And so their motto, the pro-annexationist motto, was annexation or stagnation. But at the same time, people like Silsby Spaulding, and I know these are amazing names, but Silsby Spaulding was the president of the Board of Trustees for Beverly Hills, which is what they called their city government. And even though he was also a large stakeholder in Rodeo Land and Water Company, thought that it would be best if the city remained independent. They would be able to control the schools. They would be able to control the density, they would be able to control their future. And they didn't have to look much further east to Hollywood to see what would happen.
Still, as you say, there was a group that was pro-annexation.
There was a group that was pro-annexation that did not want to spend the money, mostly the Rodeo Land and Water Company principals and realtors all wanted that water. The idea,
because that would mean growth, that would mean more money for them.
Right.
And then on the other side, you have Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, the Beverly Hills Eight.
Harold Lloyd, Tom Mix, Will Rogers, Fred Niblow, Rudolph Valentino, and Conrad Nagel. These are like the biggest stars of the day, especially Rudolph Valentino. And I think they all wanted privacy. I think it was, there was very much of their own self-interest in this. But when they campaigned and they went door to door, they learned something that celebrities would then remember forever. And that is, when Rudolph Valentino knocks on the door, whoever answers it is going to invite him in. He was the equivalent of the sexiest man alive in 1923. And that's the secret sauce of celebrities in politics. And they didn't convince everyone. I think the vote was 507 to 1 to 330. So it's about 170 votes.
Wow. What do you think would have happened had they voted the other way?
I think I think Beverly Hills would maybe be a named neighborhood in Los Angeles, like Hancock Park or Bel Air. I don't think the density would have remained low. I think the zoning laws of Los Angeles would have taken over. They have these beautiful curvilinear streets. I don't think those would have lasted. I think it would have been very much like a grid. And certainly the greensward that goes on the north side of Big Santa Monica would not be a park.
And part of your thesis is that this really ushered in the celebrity culture in terms of politics, the idea that celebrities could get involved in public life.
Yes, and it's another thing I think Mary Pickford introduced us to. I don't have any evidence because it's hard to prove a negative. It's impossible to prove a negative. But had Mary Pickford not succeeded with this endeavor, I think celebrities might have entered politics, but much more reluctantly and maybe differently. She succeeded. She sort of started the playbook. Tom Mix was a mentor to John Wayne, who influenced Ronald Reagan, who became involved in the Screen Actors Guild, who became governor of California. Helen Gehagan Douglas began her political career in the 30s. And I think they all understood that they had this ability to have, first of all, they're instantly recognizable, name recognition, that they didn't have to start with school board and dog catcher and then go to citywide offices or statewide offices, that they could start with governor, as two actors did, Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger. They just, you know, how hard can it be?
Or president.
Or president, which Ronald Reagan became president. And now our current president, who I'm still trying to understand why he wanted to do it, but it just shows that there was instant recognition. People think they know who Donald Trump is based on his tenure at The Apprentice.
So are you painting a through line from Mary Pickford to Donald Trump?
Yes, I am.
Nancy Clare is the author of The Battle for Beverly Hills, A City's Independence, and the Birth of Celebrity Politics. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, the story of one house in Beverly Hills, a house Donald Trump got for free 10 years ago, at least on paper, and then turned around and sold for more than $9 million. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, more now from 90210. We are listening to the sound of a really slick real estate video. It's a tour of 806 North Rodeo Drive. The property is very Beverly Hills, big hedge in front, pool, tennis court, many chandeliers, a good amount of marble, and gold. Lots of gold in the bathroom, the powder room, the foyer. There are enough golden accents that when you find out that President Trump once owned the house, you'd say, yeah, I could see that. But there is more to the story of this house than decor. Our colleagues at Reveal, the public radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting, found out that Trump was given the house, given as in paid $0, by a guy from Egypt who was a pastor of a small church in West L.A. Lance Williams is a senior reporter for Reveal, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks. Okay, well, let's begin at the beginning of this. When did Trump get the house, and what was the context?
Sure. If you remember, when The Apprentice moved to L.A. for a season, the president was living up on Mulholland Drive, the future president, I should say. He's kind of a man about town in L.A. He got the star on the Walk of Fame and also was shopping for luxury real estate. He bought a $7 million house just across from the Beverly Hills Hotel where he likes to stay and where those alleged liaisons took place. And then the property next door came open, and he wound up owning it, although in a really indirect way. It was purchased in 08 by an unlikely man, Egyptian emigre with no money and a history of foreclosures and tax liens and fraud lawsuits. His name was Moklis Gurgis, and he was deeded the property in what looks from the real estate papers like a $10 million deal. But 6 weeks after buying it, obtaining it, whatever the word is, he went to a real estate office with a new deed in which he was granting the property to a shell corporation that was set up to benefit Donald Trump. And he said the reason he was doing this was because when they deeded him the house, it was all a mistake.
Who deeded him the house?
Actually, the owners were Leonard and Selma Fish, prominent real estate investors on the West Side, big-time Republican political donors. And they had owned it for less than a year. Their business is buying and selling luxury property, and so they were trying to flip it. And they did, but as I say, there was this little hiccup in the way. The Egyptian with no assets was deeded the property.
So let me see if I have this straight. For many years, the dictator of Gabon owned this property. He then sells it to Leonard and Selma Fish, who want to buy it and flip it.
True.
They then sell it to this Egyptian, this Moklis Gurgis.
True.
And then 6 weeks later, he gives it to Donald Trump, or a shell company owned by Donald Trump.
That's right.
So the question is, how does that happen? How does this guy, who, as you say, really doesn't have any assets, this Egyptian, how is he giving a property worth $10+ million?
Yeah.
At the time, this is in 2008. How does he give it to Donald Trump?
Well, it's a great question. The experts who looked at this for us, the real estate lawyers who looked at this for us, said that this deal defies every norm for transacting eight-figure real estate. But the people inside, the lawyer for Mr. and Mrs. Fish and a spokesman for the First American Title Insurance Company, and Mr. Gurgis himself in his filing with the county all said, well, this was just a big mistake.
What is the innocent explanation here?
That through human error, a deed granting the property to the Egyptian emigre was filed with Los Angeles County instead of a deed granting the property to the Donald Trump Corporation.
So that it was actually Donald Trump who bought the property from Leonard and Selma Fish?
Right.
Not Moklis Gurgis.
Right.
For the 10+ million.
Yeah. So you have a scenario in which somebody had to call Mr. Trump and said, hey, you know, we gave your house to the wrong guy. I suppose problems with the explanation start with how did this guy become a prospective buyer on a $10 million house anyway, to the extent that a deed was prepared in his name? That's not the way they roll in high-end real estate. Typically, prospective buyers have to be vetted financially. You have to come in with either a bank statement showing you have the cash or be pre-approved for a mega mortgage. So that's unusual, our experts said. And then the most unusual aspect is that at closing, where you would have lawyers for Trump and for these wealthy individuals who are selling, all these real estate professionals who are there getting paid to make sure nothing goes wrong, all just completely miss that the wrong guy's name was on the deed. That just doesn't happen.
Well, what's the not-so-innocent explanation for all of that?
With our experts, they began speculating, but it is speculation. I think that but we don't want to indulge in that. I think Ross Delston, who's a consultant on financial crimes, a man we talked to, said, look, this deal includes facets that don't add up. Anyone investigating the transactions of the president would want to follow up on the oddities and red flags to see what's going on. But we just couldn't find out an alternate explanation that we could prove.
Yeah. So, but do you have your suspicions of what, you know, what might have been going on?
Something was going on, but it isn't what they said was going on, is what I believe.
Right. And so were you able to find any other connections between Moklis Gerges, this Egyptian with little money, and Leonard and Selma Fish?
No. Mr. Gerges has only that connection to Mr. and Mrs. Fish, and he had his only that connection to Donald Trump. His life in L.A., where he came with his family after they emigrated from Egypt, was starting up businesses and getting in trouble. He was sued for fraud in a real estate deal. He was sued for fraud in another real estate deal. He had tax liens. He lost some property to foreclosure. He was just scuffling. And then he had a job as a pastor of a 15-member congregation on the west side of L.A. that paid him some money. His world is nothing like Donald Trump's world.
And you weren't able to find him or interview him?
We tried our darndest, but he didn't want to be found. Like many other people in this story, we got the idea that this topic wasn't his favorite to discuss.
All right. Lance, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's Lance Williams. He's senior reporter for Reveal. He wrote the story with Matt Smith. All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback. Hello.
Hey there, Madeline. Well, Mayor Eric Garcetti gave his State of the City speech today.
He did.
And so I asked listeners what they think the state of the city is. Tor Leonard says, well, what has he actually made progress on? Trevor Song said, these initiatives on homelessness are obviously politically motivated. He's had like 5 years to do something since he got elected. Now it seems like he cares more than ever about a problem that's been in existence for many decades. Aiden Doherty said, if he can actually make substantial impact on the homelessness situation, I'd say great, run for president on that accomplishment. If not, I'd say WTF, dude, create a legacy in LA first. You know, the mayor spent the weekend in Iowa. He's done everything but declare that he's going to run for president
right in
2020. So I ran a quick Twitter poll to see whether people would vote for him. And our listeners, 49% said probably yes. 51% said probably no. So pretty even split on our listeners
is
voting
for the mayor. Is that a scientific poll? Yeah,
that's a scientific poll. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
You heard it here first.
We're going to have the mayor on the show tomorrow, so we'll ask him all about
exciting.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell him about my poll.
Sure, he'll be very interested. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.